Welcome, Deep Divers. Have you ever found yourself maybe staring at a blank character sheet for a game like Dungeons and Dragons and just thought, okay, where do I even start? How do I make a hero that feels, truly mine? Or maybe you're already playing and you're kind of curious about what really makes your adventurer tick, beneath the surface
Yeah,
stats.
that's really going on there.
Exactly. Today, we're not just going to dive into rules per se, we're exploring the magic of crafting your character, how you bring them to life from just a spark of an idea,
Right.
and what makes them capable of, well, extraordinary feats, or maybe sometimes amusing blunders. We're going to take a bit of a shortcut through the player's handbook to uncover those vital ingredients that define your adventurer. Okay, let's unpack this.
And what's fascinating here, I think, is that we're going to lay down the absolute bedrock for that creation. We're talking about your adventurer's ability scores.
The core stats, yeah.
Exactly. These aren't just like six numbers you jot down on a sheet. They are the fundamental essence of who your character is. They really breathe life into every single action, every decision, every roll of the dice you make in the game. Think of them as a quick, almost universal description of every creature's physical and mental characteristics in D&D. From the mightiest dragon all the way down to the most unassuming halfling, they literally tell you what your hero is capable of.
Absolutely. And to navigate this really crucial topic, we're relying heavily on the player's handbook. It's essentially the Bible for D&D character creation, right?
It really is the foundational text.
We've meticulously sifted through its pages, really tried to pull out the most vital nuggets, the core wisdom you need to understand your character's capabilities. And this deep dive is tailor-made for you. Whether you're maybe about to create your very first D&D character, or you're a seasoned player just looking for a fresh perspective on the fundamentals.
Yeah, maybe a refresher.
Exactly. Our mission today is for you to walk away not just informed, but genuinely excited to imagine, build, and ultimately play your own unique hero. So let's get right to the heart of it then. What is a D&D character at its core? The player's handbook describes it, I think, beautifully. It says, your character is a combination of game statistics, role-playing hooks, and your imagination.
That's a great line.
I love that phrasing because it really emphasizes that it's not just about the numbers, is it? It's about this incredible blend that creates such a rich, immersive experience.
Definitely.
You're essentially creating an avatar, right? Your
Yeah.
personal representative in the D&D world through whom you interact with everything. So your eyes, your voice, your sword arm, maybe in these fantastical realms you explore with your friends.
Exactly. And the very DNA of that avatar, and really every creature in D&D, revolves around what the game calls the sixth ability.
The big six.
The big six. These are the fundamental qualities that provide, like we said, a quick description of every being's physical and mental characteristics. They are strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma.
Gotcha.
These six scores are truly the universal language for defining everything from a, I don't know, a fierce giant to a cunning little goblin, and of course, your hero.
So when someone actually sits down, maybe with that blank sheet, what's the typical journey the player's handbook suggests? It starts way before rolling dice, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Yeah, the rolling comes later.
Yeah.
The player's handbook guides you through a pretty clear step-by-step process. First, it really urges you to start with just imagining your character. This is where the true creative spark ignites.
Right, the
You
concept.
conjure up a concept, a dream, maybe just a persona. Maybe you see a grizzled old veteran or a scholarly elf or perhaps a charming scoundrel, something like that. Once you have that mental image, then you move into the mechanical choices that help solidify it. You'll choose a race, like a human, an elf, a dwarf, or a halfling. And this choice is incredibly significant
Yeah, how so?
because, as the book says, it not only affects your ability scores and traits, but also provides the cues for building your character's story. It gives you immediate flavor and some mechanical grounding.
Okay.
After that, you pick a class, fighter, wizard, rogue, cleric, whatever fits your concept. This determines your primary role in the game. Are you going to be a frontline combatant, a powerful spellcaster, a sneaky expert?
Your job in the party, basically.
Exactly, your niche.
Yeah.
And the class immediately suggests which abilities will be most important for you. And then finally, you invent the personality, appearance, and backstory of your character.
And that's not just tacked on at the end.
No, it's crucial to remember that these aren't just separate elements you bolt on. They're deeply intertwined. They should work together to create a cohesive, believable, and hopefully unique adventurer.
Okay, so how does all this kind of come together in practice? Do you have an example, maybe from the source material, that really ties these threads together, makes it concrete?
Yeah, the Player's Handbook gives us a fantastic example with Brunor Battlehammer. He's a pretty iconic character.
Ah, the dwarf fighter.
The dwarf fighter himself.
Okay.
So imagine a mountain dwarf fighter. His race, dwarf, immediately gives him a natural inclination towards high strength and constitution. That's baked into being a mountain dwarf.
Right, they're tough.
They are tough. This makes him incredibly tough and powerful, perfect for charging into battle with his axe, taking hits, and staying on his feet. His class, fighter, reinforces that, focusing his skills on martial prowess and direct combat.
Makes sense.
But it's not all about brawn, right? His character also has a relatively low intelligence score. And this isn't presented as just a penalty. It's actually a narrative opportunity.
How so?
It suggests maybe a degree of gruff forgetfulness or perhaps a lack of book learning.
Yeah.
You know, he's not spending his time in libraries. And that can be a great role-playing hook, something fun to play. Brunor also has a lawful good alignment. That indicates he's got a strong moral compass, a dedication to order and justice, even if he sometimes applies it, well, gruffly.
Wow.
And then his background is that of a folk hero. This reveals a lot. It tells us he comes from a noble line, was expelled from his homeland when he was young, grew up working as a smith, and he's actually destined to reclaim his ancestral home.
Wow. Okay, so that's a lot packed into the background.
It is. So you see how his stats, his high strength and constitution, directly connect to his story elements, his physical might, his endurance for battle,
right,
and his low intelligence, that forgetfulness, it informs his personality. It could lead to potentially amusing or even challenging situations in the game.
Like forgetting where he put his keys,
yeah,
or the sacred artifact.
Exactly. And his folk hero background gives him this soft spot for orphans and wayward souls, which influences his decisions, maybe even when showing mercy isn't the most practical choice for a hardened warrior. It's all interconnected. It paints this vibrant picture of a character who feels, well, real.
That's a perfect illustration. Yeah, it really shows how the numbers aren't just arbitrary. They support the narrative you're building. And the Player's Handbook doesn't stop with Brunor, does it? It mentions others, too.
That's right. It also briefly mentions other iconic characters, like Teeka Whalen. She's a human fighter from the Dragonlance setting.
Oh, yeah, the barmaid with the frying pan.
And that's her, a brash teenager with a rough childhood, famous for using that frying pan as one of her favorite weapons. And her street-learned skills prove invaluable. Then you have someone totally different, like Artemis Ontreri.
Ah, Drist's rival.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A lawful, evil human fighter. Very skilled, very dangerous. He's described as impartial, driven by a lust for power, and he never lets his emotions master him.
So completely different vibe from Brunor, even though they're both fighters.
Totally different. And what I find so compelling about these examples is just the sheer breadth of possibilities.
Mm.
Even with similar mechanical roles like fighter, the stories, the personalities, the approaches to adventuring can be incredibly unique.
Mm.
This flexibility, this is what makes D&D so endlessly replayable and personal for you.
Okay, now let's really zoom in. We've talked about these six abilities as the fundamental qualities, but what do they actually mean in game terms? Think of them as the core engine of your character. They determine what your character is naturally good at, what they might struggle with, and how they ultimately interact with the world around them. Here's where it gets really interesting, because these numbers are going to influence almost everything you do.
That's right. Each of these six abilities, strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma, has a numerical score. Typically for player characters, it ranges somewhere from 3 to 18 at the start, though it can definitely go higher later on. This score then generates an ability modifier, a bonus, or sometimes a penalty that you add to various dice rolls. Basically, a higher score means a higher modifier, which translates directly to a better chance of success when you roll the dice.
Okay, makes sense. Let's break them down. Where should we start? Strength.
Let's start with strength, STR. This is pretty straightforward. It's all about raw physical power, athleticism, and brute might. The core insight here, I think, is that strength isn't just about swinging a big axe, though it helps with that too. It's your character's raw physical will to overcome obstacles. If your dungeon master asks you to make a strength check, they're asking things like, can you lift that heavy portcullis? Can you push open that stuck, rusted door? Can you pull a lever that hasn't moved in centuries? Or maybe even grapple a monstrous foe?
Okay, physical force.
Exactly.
Yep.
It also determines how far you can jump, both high jump and long jump, and crucially, how much gear you can carry without being slowed down. The primary skill associated with strength is athletics.
Right. Athletics. What does that cover?
Athletics covers things like climbing sheer cliffs, swimming through rough waters, or performing those powerful jumps we mentioned. It's about applying your strength in athletic ways.
Gotcha. So which classes really rely on strength?
Well, barbarians are the prime example. They want a high strength score because they're frontline combatants, relying on their physical prowess to smash enemies and, you know, shrug off damage. The player's handbook is pretty explicit. For a barbarian, you should put your highest ability score in strength. Fighters often prioritize it too, as do paladins and sometimes rangers, depending on their build.
And how does it impact the dice?
Your strength modifier gets added to strength-based attack rolls, usually melee weapons, unless they have the finesse property. It also applies to strength saving throws, which might involve resisting being pushed or knocked prone by a powerful force. And of course, it applies to those strength athletics skill checks.
Okay, so strength is the brawn. What about speed and precision? The opposite end, maybe?
That brings us neatly to dexterity, DX. Dexterity measures things like agility, reflexes, balance, and fine motor control. It's all about how quickly and precisely your character can move and react, and it's incredibly versatile.
How so? More than strength.
Well, it influences a lot of different things. For example, your dexterity helps determine your initiative. That's who goes first in combat. Huge tactical advantage.
Oh, right. Initiative, yeah.
It also directly impacts your armor class. AC, especially if you're wearing light or medium armor or no armor at all. It reflects your ability to dodge attacks, to just not be where the blow lands.
So higher dexterity means harder to hit.
Generally, yes. The key skills tied to dexterity are acrobatics, for maintaining balance on, say, a tightrope or performing agile stunts and dives, sleight of hand for things like picking pockets, planting evidence, or concealing small objects, and stealth, which is all about moving unseen and unheard.
Sounds like rogue territory.
Absolutely. Rogues are the quintessential dexterity class. They use their agility for evasive maneuvers in combat, for precise attacks, often with finesse weapons or ranged weapons, and of course for blending into shadows. But rangers, bards, and monks also rely heavily on dexterity. Many ranged weapon attacks, like firing a bow or crossbow, use your dexterity modifier for the attack roll.
Can you give an example of a dexterity check?
Sure. Imagine you have to land on your feet after jumping down from a height onto difficult, maybe slippery terrain. The DM might ask for a DC 10 dexterity acrobatics check to see if you stick the landing or stumble.
Okay. And the dice impact?
Dexterity determines your modifier for dexterity-based attack rolls, ranged weapons, finesse weapons, dexterity saving throws, which are super common for dodging things like a dragon's fiery breath, a wizard's fireball, or a collapsing trap. And naturally, all those dexterity skill checks, acrobatics, sleight of hand, and stealth.
Okay, so strength gets you through the wall, maybe breaks it down. Dexterity gets you around it, or maybe over it quickly and quietly. But what keeps you going when things get really tough, when you take a hit?
Ah, that's where Constitution C on N comes in. This ability measures your character's endurance, stamina, vitality, and overall physical resilience. It's truly vital for every single class.
Every class, even like a wizard.
Absolutely, from the toughest warrior to the most physically frail wizard. Because Constitution directly influences your character's hit points, that's the measure of how much damage they can take before being knocked unconscious or worse.
Right, HP, super important.
Super important. For example, a barbarian gets a D12, the biggest hit die, for their hit points each level. Plus, they add their Constitution modifier. So a high con makes them incredibly tough. But even a wizard with a smaller hit die like a D6 still adds their con modifier.
Sure.
More con means more HP, which means staying conscious longer.
What else does Constitution affect?
It also determines things like how long you can hold your breath underwater, or your general resistance to poisons, diseases, and other debilitating physical effects. It's also critical for spellcasters, actually.
Why spellcasters?
Because many powerful spells require concentration. If you're concentrating on a spell and you take damage, you have to make a Constitution saving throw to see if you can maintain the spell. A higher con modifier makes that save easier to pass.
Ah, okay, I see. So it protects your spells, too.
Exactly. For frontline combatants especially, a high constitution means they can simply take more punishment and stay in the fight longer. Looking at races, rock gnomes are a great example. They get a natural +1 constitution bonus, making them inherently a bit hardier.
And on that dice.
Constitution determines your modifier for constitution saving throws, those crucial saves against poison, disease, exhaustion, and effects that target your physical resilience, plus those concentration checks. And of course, it directly impacts your character's survivability through their total hit points at every single level.
Okay, we've covered the physical side, strength, dexterity, constitution. Let's move into the mental side of things now. What does a character with high intelligence truly represent?
Okay, intelligence, INT. This ability measures your character's reasoning, memory, analytical ability, and formal education or knowledge. This is really about what your character knows and how well they can apply that knowledge logically.
So, book smarts.
Often, yeah, but also analytical skill. The primary skills tied to intelligence are arcana, which is knowledge of magic, magical traditions, planes of existence, and things like that. History, covering past events, ancient kingdoms, lost lore. Investigation, which is different from perception investigation, is about finding clues, making deductions, figuring out how a trap works by examining it.
Okay, deductive reasoning.
Exactly. Then there's nature, dealing with knowledge of animals, plants, terrain, weather patterns. And finally, religion, concerning deities, holy symbols, religious rites, the structure of pantheons.
So a lot of knowledge skills.
Definitely. Intelligence influences your ability to recall obscure lore, solve complex puzzles, decipher codes, the keen mind feat, for example, once you create codes with a DC equal to your IN score plus proficiency bonus. It's about understanding complex information. And, crucially, it's the primary spellcasting ability for wizards.
Right. Wizards need to be smart.
They do. They learn spells through intense study and understanding of the mechanics of magic. Race-wise, rock gnomes excel here, too. They get a +2 bonus to their intelligence. The player's handbook mentions an example of a character named Philip making an intelligence investigation check to determine if some gargoyles were actual creatures waiting to attack or just inert decorations. A pretty crucial distinction to make.
Yeah, I'd say so. Dice impact.
Intelligence determines your modifier for all those intelligence skill checks we listed, and also for intelligence saving throws, though those are less common than, say, dexterity or wisdom saves. But it is absolutely crucial for a wizard spell save difficulty class, DC, the number enemies have to beat to resist their spells and their spell attack modifier.
Okay, so intelligence is about book smarts, logic, and knowing stuff. But what about, like, street smarts? Common sense? Gut feelings?
Yeah, now you're talking about wisdom. W-I-S. Wisdom measures your character's awareness, intuition, insight, common sense, and willpower. This is less about knowing facts and more about perceiving the world accurately, understanding situations and people, and reacting instinctively or appropriately.
So more about perception and intuition.
Precisely. The key skills associated with wisdom are animal handling, for calming down creatures, understanding their intentions, or controlling a mount. Insight, which is huge for social encounters, discerning true intentions, spotting lies, getting a read on someone. Medicine, for diagnosing illnesses, stabilizing dying companions, providing basic first aid. Perception, probably one of the most rolled skills in the game, noticing subtle details, hearing faint sounds, spotting hidden things or ambushes. And survival, for tracking creatures, foraging for food and water, navigating in the wilderness, predicting weather.
Wow, perception and survival sound essential for adventurers.
They really are. Wisdom influences your ability to notice hidden threats before they become a problem, get that gut feeling about a shady deal, or understand the underlying emotions in a social interaction. It's the primary spellcasting ability for clerics and druids who draw their power from divine sources or the natural world, relying on insight and connection rather than pure intellect. It's also really important for rangers and monks. Basically, it's critical for any character who needs to be observant and aware of their surroundings.
You mentioned passive perception earlier.
Yes. Your passive wisdom perception score, which is 10 plus your perception modifier, is often used by the DM to determine if you notice hidden threats while traveling or exploring without you having to say, I searched the room.
Yeah.
Represents your general awareness. You might also make an active wisdom saving throw to resist effects like being frightened by a terrifying monster or charmed by a powerful spell like dominant person.
Okay. And for the dice?
Wisdom determines your modifier for all those wisdom skill checks. And for wisdom saving throws, which are really important for resisting mental effects, illusions, charms, fear. And, just like intelligence for wizards, wisdom is crucial for a cleric's or druid's spell save DC and their spell attack modifier.
Right. One more to go. The ability that often defines our heroes in sagas and stories.
Yeah.
The smooth talkers, the leaders.
Indeed. Last but certainly not least, we have charisma. CHA. Charisma measures your character's force of personality, their persuasiveness, leadership qualities, and social grace. It's all about how you interact with others, how you present yourself, and your ability to influence the world through sheer presence, confidence, or charm.
So it's not just about being likable.
Not necessarily, no. You can have high charisma and be incredibly intimidating or manipulative. It's about the force of your personality. The key skills here reflect that range. Deception, for convincingly hiding the truth, telling believable lies, fast-talking your way out of trouble, or running a con. Intimidation, for influencing others through threats, hostile actions, or sheer menace. Performance, for entertaining people, captivating an audience with music, dance, acting, storytelling. And persuasion, for influencing others through charm, reasoned arguments, tact, or good-natured appeals.
Okay, so the social skills, basically.
The core social skills, yes. Mm. Charisma influences pretty much all your interactions with non-player characters, NPCs. Your ability to gather rumors in a tavern, to negotiate a deal, to lead your allies into battle, or inspire them to achieve great things. It's also the primary spellcasting ability for several classes, bards, paladins, sorcerers, and warlocks.
Ah, interesting mix there.
Yeah, these are classes that often derive their power from sheer force of will, innate magical talent, a divine oath, or a pact made through personal conviction or negotiation. Races like half-elves and tieflings get a significant +2 increase to their charisma score, making them naturally suited to these roles.
You mentioned an interesting variant check earlier, strength for intimidation.
Yes. The player's handbook gives that great example of maybe a half-orc barbarian making a strength intimidation check. This really highlights the flexibility. Instead of using smooth words, charisma, they're using their raw physical might, maybe crushing something in their hand or looming menacingly, to intimidate someone. It shows how an ability like strength can be combined with a typically charisma-based skill to reflect a specific approach.
I like that. It adds flavor. What about charisma's impact on dice?
Charisma determines your modifier for all those charisma skill checks: deception, intimidation, performance, persuasion. It also applies to charisma saving throws, which are sometimes used to resist effects like banishment or certain forms of planar manipulation. And of course, it's crucial for the spell save DC and spell attack modifier for bards, paladins, sorcerers, and warlocks.
So what does this all mean for you, the player, when you're looking at these six scores? It really means these aren't just arbitrary labels or numbers you need to worry about. They are the fundamental building blocks of your character's capabilities and how they navigate the world. Every difficult climb, every hidden trap you spot, every inspiring speech you give, every spell you sling, it's all filtered through these six core attributes. They truly define what your character can do and how they do it.
Okay, so now that we've kind of unpacked what each ability represents, let's connect them much more explicitly to the actual gameplay, to the mechanics. D&D is famous for its dice, right?
Oh, yeah. The click-clack math rocks.
Exactly. And these abilities are intricately linked to them. The game uses, as the player's handbook states, polyhedral dice with different numbers of sides. You'll hear terms like D4, D6, D8, D10, D12, and the star of the show, the D20.
The 20-sider, yeah.
You also have percentile dice, or D100, which are usually two D10s, one for the tens digit, one for the ones. But yeah, the D20 is really at the heart of most checks in the game. It determines success or failure for nearly every meaningful action you attempt where the outcome is uncertain.
Okay, so the D20 is key, but it's not just the D20 roll, is it? We add stuff.
Right. Beyond your ability scores and those modifiers we just discussed, there's another crucial element called the proficiency bonus. Right. Think of this bonus as representing your character's professional training, their focused practice, or maybe even just an innate talent in a specific area. It's a numerical bonus and gets added to roles where your character has specific expertise.
Where does it apply specifically?
You'll add your proficiency bonus to a few key areas. First, to attack rolls made with weapons you're proficient with, if you're a fighter trained with longswords, you add it when attacking with a longsword. Same goes for attack rolls with spells you cast.
Okay, attacks. What else?
Second, you add it to ability checks using skills you're proficient in. So if your character is proficient in the athletic skill, you'd add your proficiency bonus in addition to your strength modifier whenever you make a strength athletics check.
Ah, so it stacks with the ability modifier for skills you're good at.
Exactly. Third, you add it to saving throws you're proficient in. Each class grants proficiency in two saving throws. A wizard, for instance, is typically proficient in intelligence and wisdom saves, so they add their bonus to those saves.
Got
it. Also plays a role in determining your spell save DC, the difficulty for enemies resisting your spells. The formula is 8 plus your proficiency bonus plus your spellcasting ability modifier. And finally, if you're using tools you're proficient with, like thieves' tools for picking locks or maybe artisans' tools for crafting, you add your proficiency bonus to checks made with those tools too.
That's a lot of places. Is there a limit?
Yes. There's a critical rule to remember. Your proficiency bonus can't be added to a single die roll or other number more than once. Even if multiple things seem like they should grant it, you only get it once per roll.
Okay, no double dipping. Does it stay the same?
No, gets better. This bonus isn't static. It increases at certain levels as your character gains experience and mastery. It starts at +2 at level 1 and goes up incrementally, reaching +6 at higher levels.
Okay, so proficiency makes you better at your toes and stuff over time. Makes sense. So back to that chasm jump example, how does proficiency and the ability modifier come into play there?
Great question. That brings us directly to ability checks in more detail. When your character attempts to do something where the outcome is uncertain, and it isn't a direct attack or a saving throw, the game usually asks you to roll a d20 and add the appropriate ability modifier.
Right.
So for your chasm jump, that's fundamentally a test of strength. You'd roll a d20 and add your strength modifier. Now, if your character is proficient in the athletics skill, maybe they're a trained acrobat or just naturally athletic, you also add your proficiency bonus to that d20 roll.
So d20 plus strength mod plus proficiency bonus if proficient in athletics?
Precisely. A skill isn't really a separate thing. It's just a specific application of an ability score. It clarifies how you're using that strength or dexterity or whatever. So instead of just a raw dexterity check, you might make a dexterity acrobatics check for balancing, or a wisdom perception check to notice a hidden detail. The DM sets a difficulty class, or DC, which is the target number you need to meet or beat on your total roll to succeed.
And this is where that clever bit comes in, the variant skill checks you mentioned. This sounds like an aha moment for a lot of players.
It really can be, because normally you think athletic strength. But the player's handbook points out, what if you have to swim a really long distance across a wide, stormy bay? Raw strength matters, but endurance matters more. So your DM might ask for a constitution athletics check instead, using your constitution modifier plus proficiency if applicable, to see if you have the sheer stamina for it.
Oh, interesting. Swapping the ability score.
Exactly. Or that half-orc barbarian wanting to intimidate someone. Instead of the standard charisma intimidation check using personality, the DM might allow a strength intimidation check to reflect them using raw physical power and menace flexing, maybe snapping a thick branch, you know?
Yeah. That's just such great flexibility, doesn't it? It makes the game feel more dynamic and responsive to how your character would actually approach things, not just sticking rigidly to the skill list.
Absolutely. It allows for so much narrative depth and creative play. Now, beyond these active roles where you're trying to do something, there are also passive checks.
Right, passive perception you mentioned. How does that work again?
A passive check total is a score. It's not a roll. It's equal to 10 plus the character's ability modifier plus proficiency bonus, if they're proficient in the relevant skill.
Hmm.
These are mainly used when the DM needs to know if your character notices something without you having to actively say, I look around. It represents your baseline awareness.
So like noticing a hidden tripwire while walking down a corridor?
Exactly. The book gives an example. If a first level character has a wisdom of 15, so a +2 modifier, and proficiency in perception, +2 bonus, he or she has a passive wisdom score of 14. That 14 becomes the DC for creatures trying to hide from them. Your dexterity, stealth check, your active attempt to hide, is contested by a creature's passive wisdom perception score.
Gotcha. Passive sets the baseline difficulty for others' stealth. What about working together?
Good point. If two or more characters try to accomplish a task together, like pushing open a massive stone door, the leading character, or maybe the one with the highest relevant modifier, can often make the ability check with advantage, reflecting the help provided by the other characters. In combat, this is formalized as the help action, where you use your action to give an ally advantage on their next ability check or attack roll.
Okay, advantage. We'll come back to that. What about saves? Saving throws. How are they different from ability checks?
The key difference is choice. You choose to make an ability check, I want to climb the wall. A saving throw is usually reactive. It's an attempt to resist a spell, a trap, a poison, a disease, or a similar threat. You don't choose to make one, you're forced to when your character is put at risk by something external.
Okay, involuntary reaction. How's the roll work?
The formula is pretty straightforward. You roll a d20 and add the appropriate ability modifier, just like an ability check base. Then, if your class grants you proficiency in that specific saving throw, remember, each class gets 2 proficiencies, like a wizard being proficient in intelligence and wisdom saves. You also add your proficiency bonus.
And what are you rolling against?
You're rolling against the difficulty class, DC, set by whatever caused the save. For a skull, for example, the DC is typically 8 plus the caster's spellcasting ability modifier plus the caster's proficiency bonus. For a trap or poison, the DC is set by the DM based on its potency. The outcome usually means that a successful save results in no harm or reduced harm, depending on the specific effect. Failing a save, well, that's usually when the bad stuff happens. Mm-hmm. These are critical for your character's survival.
Definitely sounds like it. Okay, what about the thing players do most in combat? Hitting stuff, attack rolls.
Right, the core of combat. When you swing that sword, fire that arrow, or hurl that magic missile, you make an attack roll to see if you hit. This is almost always a d20 roll. You add your relevant ability modifier, usually strength for most melee attacks, unless it's a finesse weapon like a rapier or short sword, then you can use dexterity. For ranged attacks like bows or crossbows, it's almost always dexterity. For spell attacks, it's your spellcasting ability modifier. Int for wizards, wits for clerics, chaff for sorcerers, etc.
So d20 plus ability mod. Anything else?
Yes. You also add your proficiency bonus if you're proficient with a specific weapon you're using or if it's a spell attack. Most classes grant proficiency with a range of weapons.
Okay. D20 plus ability mod plus proficiency bonus if proficient. What about rolling a 20 or a 1?
Ah, the criticals.
Yeah.
Attack rolls have special outcomes for those extreme rolls on the D20 itself before modifiers. A natural 20, meaning the die shows a 20, hits regardless of any modifiers or the target's AC. It's an automatic hit. Even better, it's a critical hit.
Which means
you get to roll all the damage dice for the attack twice, then add your modifier once. So much more damage. Conversely, a natural 1 on the d20 misses regardless of any modifiers or the target's AC. Automatic miss. Often called a critical fumble, though the official rules just say it's a miss.
Gotcha. Any other quirks with attacks?
One important one for ranged attacks. If you are within 5 feet of a hostile creature that can see you and that isn't incapacitated, you have disadvantage on your ranged attack roll. It's hard to line up a bow shot when someone's right in your face trying to stab you.
Makes sense. Okay, so you hit. Now what? Damage rolls.
Right. Hitting is only half the battle. Now you roll damage. For weapon attacks, you roll the weapon's damage, die or dice, like a d8 for a longsword, or 2d6 for a great axe, and you add your ability modifier, the same modifier used for the attack roll, to the damage.
Ah, so strength helps you hit harder with a sword, and dex helps you hit harder with a bow.
Exactly. Magic weapons, special abilities like a rogue sneak attack, or class features like a paladin's divine smite, can add further dice or bonuses to the damage roll. For spell attacks, the spell's description itself tells you which dice to roll for damage and whether to add any modifiers. Some spells add your modifier, others don't.
And damage isn't all the same, is it? There are types.
Correct. Damage comes in various types. The most common physical types are slashing from swords, piercing from arrows or daggers, and bludgeoning from hammers or falling. Then you have energy types like fire, cold, lightning, thunder, acid, poison. And more esoteric types like necrotic, death energy, radiant, holy energy, psychic, mental force, and force, pure magical energy.
Why do the types matter?
Because creatures can have resistance to certain damage types, which means they take only half damage from that type. Or, more rarely, they might have vulnerability, meaning damage of that type is doubled. These resistances and vulnerabilities are applied after all other modifiers and bonuses are calculated. Knowing your enemy's weaknesses can be key.
Wow, okay, so you can really see how all these numbers, your ability scores, your proficiency bonus, the dice rolls, even damage types, all come together to form this intricate engine that drives every single action your character takes in D&D. It's a consistent, logical system, but it really quantifies your hero's triumphs and tribulations, making every success feel earned and every failure.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully instructional. All right, so if ability scores and proficiency are like the foundational engine of your character's capabilities, then advantage and disadvantage. These feel like the turbo boost or maybe the emergency brake, right? They dramatically alter your chances of success or failure in a really elegant way, reflecting the dynamic circumstances of your adventure.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
The core mechanic itself is wonderfully simple, which is one of its strengths. The player's handbook explains. When you have either advantage or disadvantage, you roll a second d20 when you make the roll. Use the higher of the two rolls if you have advantage, and use the lower roll if you have disadvantage.
So two dice, pick the best for advantage, pick the worst for disadvantage.
Exactly. So to use the example straight from the book, if you have disadvantage and roll a 17 and a 5, you use the 5. If you instead have advantage and roll those numbers, you use the 17. This system is really powerful because it simplifies what used to be a whole mess of situational pluses and minuses in older editions. Now it's just this one clear rule, making decisions at the table faster, more intuitive, and it really makes circumstances matter.
Yeah, it feels impactful. Let's explore some common situations where advantage or disadvantage come into play, pulling directly from the source material again, because understanding these can really change your tactical approach in the game. It's like the game's way of saying, things are going really well for you right now, or, uh-oh, things are going really poorly.
Mm-hmm.
So you get advantage when circumstances strongly favor you. What are some common ways that happens?
Okay, one of the most common scenarios is attacking someone who can't see you. The rule is clear. When a creature can't see you, you have advantage on attack rolls against it. This is huge for rogues using their hide action, or anyone attacking from, say, heavy fog or magical darkness if they can somehow see through it.
Makes sense if they can't see it coming.
Exactly. Similarly, if you are an invisible creature, the rules state that your attack rolls have advantage, and attacks against you have disadvantage. Big benefit.
Okay. What else gives advantage?
Many racial traits grant advantage in specific situations. We mentioned elves and half-elves having fey ancestry earlier that grants advantage on saving throws against being charmed. It's a very potent defense against certain kinds of mind-altering magic.
Nice racial perk. Class features, too.
Definitely. Lots of class features grant advantage. A barbarian's feral instinct feature at 7th level gives them advantage on initiative rolls, meaning they're often quicker to react when combat breaks out.
Getting the jump on enemies?
Right. Even some monster abilities reflect this principle, like a wolf's pack tactics. The rule states, the wolf has advantage on attack rolls against a creature if at least one of the wolf's allies is within 5 feet of the creature and isn't incapacitated. This gives a real tactical feel to how pack animals hunt together.
Yeah, encourages teamwork, even for monsters.
And paladins, at 7th level, get Aura of Devotion, which means you and friendly creatures within 10 feet of you can't be charmed while you're conscious. While it doesn't explicitly say advantage, it effectively negates the charmed condition, which often imposes disadvantage or worse. So it's a powerful protective aura.
Okay, so lots of ways to gain advantage. What about the flip side? Disadvantage. When do things get harder?
Disadvantage often comes from being impaired by negative conditions, difficult circumstances, or specific abilities working against you.
Like trying to see in the dark.
Exactly. If you're in a lightly obscured area, like dim light, patchy fog, or moderate foliage, the rules say creatures have disadvantage on wisdom perception checks that rely on sight. You just can't see as clearly.
And heavily obscured, like total darkness.
Heavily obscured areas like darkness, opaque fog, or dense foliage effectively block vision entirely. This causes the blinded condition. And being blinded is a double whammy. Attack rolls against the creature have advantage because they can't see you, and the creature's attack rolls have disadvantage because they can't see their target.
Ouch. Okay, what other conditions cause disadvantage?
Being poisoned is a common one. A poisoned creature has disadvantage on attack rolls and ability checks. It really hampers your effectiveness.
Makes sense. What about being knocked down?
That's the prone condition lying on the ground. When you're prone, the creature has disadvantage on attack rolls. However, attacks against a prone creature have advantage if the attacker is within 5 feet, easy target, but disadvantage if the attacker is further away, smaller profile.
Interesting trade-off there.
Yeah. Then there's the restrained condition. Maybe you're tangled in webs or held fast by magic. That's also tough. Attack rolls against the creature have advantage, and the creature's attack rolls have disadvantage. You're tied up, easy to hit, and it's hard to fight back effectively.
Can classes impose disadvantage on enemies?
Oh, yeah. Some monk subclasses, like the Way of the Open Hand, have features that can impose disadvantage on a target's strength saving throws after hitting them with flurry of blows. A paladin using the protection fighting style can use their reaction to impose disadvantage on an attack roll made against an ally standing within 5 feet of them.
Protecting their buddies.
Right. And some high-level features offer protection from advantage. An 18th level rogue gets elusive, which means no attack roll has advantage against you while you aren't incapacitated. Makes them incredibly hard to pin down.
Wow. Okay. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, advantage and disadvantage. They're really more than just a mechanical tweak, aren't they?
Absolutely. They are brilliant narrative tools woven directly into the mechanics. They reflect the story's ebb and flow. Are you hidden? Is the enemy blinded? Are you poisoned? Are your allies helping you? It makes the circumstances of the scene truly matter in a tangible way on the dice. They tell you, at a glance, whether the situation favors your character or not, integrating the world's conditions directly into the gameplay. It creates this palpable sense of tension or triumph, based purely on the unfolding narrative, making the game feel much more alive and responsive to your actions and the world around you.
So we've broken down what each ability score means, how they translate into dice rolls, and how advantage and disadvantage can swing things. Now let's kind of circle back and tie it all together with where we started, your initial character choices. It really is this beautiful dance between your character concept and the mechanical crunch, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And those foundational choices you make right at the beginning have lasting implications for your ability scores and how they play out. Let's start with race and ability scores again. We touched on it. But every race gets an ability score increase as a core racial trait. This is a crucial early choice that shapes your character's inherent strengths and weaknesses.
Right, like the mountain dwarf getting strength and constitution.
Exactly. A mountain dwarf gets a hefty +2 to strength and a +2 to constitution. Boom. Right there. They're naturally suited to being a robust, powerful frontline warrior. Compare that to a high elf who gains +2 dexterity and +1 intelligence, perfectly suiting them for agile combat, perhaps as a rogue or ranger, or for arcane study as a wizard.
And humans are the adaptable ones.
Right. Standard humans get a +1 to all 6 ability scores, giving them incredible versatility and broad competence. Then you have half-elves, who get that significant +2 to charisma, plus they get to increase 2 other ability scores of their choice by 1. Makes them natural leaders, diplomats, or maybe charismatic spellcasters like bards or sorcerers.
And the rock gnomes we mentioned.
Rock gnomes, known for their inventiveness, gain +2 intelligence and +1 constitution. Great for wizards, obviously, but also gives them a bit of extra toughness. The player's handbook even makes a neat point about considering age as a factor.
Oh yeah, how does age play in?
It suggests that a young or very old character, your age could explain a particularly low strength or constitution score, while advanced age could account for a high intelligence or wisdom. It's a way to use narrative flavor your character's age to justify or explain their ability scores. These aren't just flavor text points. They directly influence the numbers you start with and shape your character's inherent capabilities right from level 1.
Okay, so race sets a baseline. Then comes class. How does that shape your abilities further?
Your chosen class fundamentally shapes your character's abilities and, more importantly, how you use them. The player's handbook is really helpful here because it gives suggested highest ability scores for each class.
Right, like strength for barbarian, charisma for bard.
Exactly. Barbarian. Strength, then constitution. Bard. Charisma, yeah. Then dexterity. Wizard. Intelligence, first and foremost. These suggestions aren't mandatory, but they guide you towards making a mechanically effective character that aligns well with the class's typical role and features.
And classes give you more than just suggestions, right? They give proficiencies.
Huge point. Beyond just guiding your score placement, your class grants you specific weapon proficiencies, your saving throw proficiencies, and some of your skill and tool proficiencies, all of which interact directly with your ability scores via that crucial proficiency bonus we talked about. A fighter gets more weapon options than a wizard and different saving throw strengths.
So the class defines what you're good at using your scores for.
Precisely. And as your character progresses, as they level up, they'll also gain ability score improvement, ASI features, at certain levels, typically levels 4, 8, 12, 16, and 19 for most classes. These usually allow you to increase 1 ability score by 2 or 2 different ability scores by 1 up to a maximum score of 20.
Ah, so you get to boost your scores as you adventure.
Yes. This allows you to further refine your character's strengths, maybe shore up a weakness, or qualify for certain feats as they grow and evolve through their adventures.
Okay, so race and class lay a huge foundation for your numbers. But you mentioned it's not just the big ticket items. Even your character's background and experiences play a role in defining how they interact with the world through these scores, right?
They absolutely do, and backgrounds are a fantastic example of this integration in the rules. We know your background gives you additional skill and tool proficiencies.
Right, like the acolyte getting insight and religion.
Exactly. An acolyte gains proficiency in insight and religion, reflecting their time spent in temples, understanding spiritual matters, and maybe people's hidden motives. A criminal, on the other hand, might become proficient in deception and stealth, skills honed during their past life of illicit activities.
So more skills based on their history.
Yes. But crucially, backgrounds are much more than just a couple of skill bumps. The player's handbook vividly describes them as role-playing hooks that provide suggestions for personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws, as well as sometimes equipment and social features. Think back to Brunor with his folk hero background, or Tika Whelan's street urchin past giving her practical skills. These backgrounds don't just give them proficiencies. They inform their entire worldview, their connections, their motivations, and how they might approach a challenge using their abilities maybe through diplomacy, intimidation, stealth, or a well-placed lie learned on the streets.
It really fleshes them out beyond the class.
Completely. And then, for players who want even more customization, there are feats. These are an optional rule, but most games use them. They're incredibly powerful ways to further specialize your character.
How do they work? You take them instead of boosting scores.
Exactly. Instead of taking that ability score improvement when you reach certain levels, you can choose to take a feat instead. Feats grant you a special ability or a talent, something unique that sets your character apart. And crucially, these feats often directly interact with your abilities and dice rolls, making your character building choices even more strategic.
Can you give some examples? How do they tie into abilities?
Sure. Let's look at a few straight from the player's handbook. Take the heavily armored feat. If you meet the prerequisite, medium armor proficiency, it lets you increase your strength score by 1 up to 20, and you gain proficiency with heavy armor. So it directly buffs an ability score and grants a major defensive capability.
Okay, boost strength and get better armor. Nice.
Or heavy armor master. If you're already wearing heavy armor, this increases your strength by 1, again up to 20, and you gain damage reduction. You reduce any non-magical bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing damage you take by 3. Directly impacts your survivability, reinforcing that physical toughness linked to strength.
Wow, that's tanky. What about non-combat feats?
Absolutely. Look at Inspiring Leader. If you have a charisma score of 13 or higher, you can spend 10 minutes inspiring your companions, granting them temporary hit points equal to your level plus your charisma modifier. It's a fantastic way for a charismatic character to use their personality to bolster and protect their friends.
Temporary HP is always good. Intelligence feats.
Keen Mind is a classic. It increases your intelligence score by 1, lets you always know which way is north, always know the hours left until sunrise, sunset, and grants you perfect recall of anything you saw or heard within the past month. Even lets you create secret codes. Fantastic for a scholar, investigator, or anyone who needs a sharp mind.
Perfect recall. That's amazing. Any for fighters.
Martial Adept lets you learn 2 combat maneuvers from the Battlemaster fighter archetype and gain a superiority die to fuel them. Many maneuvers impose conditions or require saving throws from the enemy, often based on a DC calculated using your strength or dexterity modifier, plus your proficiency bonus. Adds tactical combat options directly tied to your physical ability.
So more tricks up your sleeve. What about defense?
Shield Master is great for characters using a shield. You get several benefits. You can add your shield's AC bonus to dexterity saving throws against spells or effects that target only you. And if you succeed on a dex save that normally deals half damage, you can use your reaction to take no damage instead, using your shield to deflect the effect entirely. Dramatically enhances defensive capabilities.
Evasion with a shield. Cool. Spellcasters.
Spell Sniper is perfect for ranged spellcasters. It doubles the range of any spell you cast that has an attack roll. Your ranged spell attacks also ignore half cover and 3/4 cover. Plus, you'll learn 1 extra cantrip that requires an attack roll, and the spellcasting ability depends on which class list you chose it from. Int for wizard list, west for cleric, chaff for sorcerer. Great for blasting from afar.
Keeping your distance.
Yeah.
And general weapon users.
Weapon Master lets you increase your strength or dexterity score by 1, and you gain proficiency with 4 simple or martial weapons of your choice. Excellent for broadening your combat options or picking up a specific weapon vital to your character concept while also getting a small ability boost.
These feats really sound like where your character's unique story meets their mechanical expression. They let you truly define your character's specific strengths, their quirks, their specialized talents, and in turn, exactly how they interact with the world through those crucial dice rolls. It's all about making your character uniquely yours, isn't it? A hero whose capabilities aren't just a pile of numbers, but true reflections of their very being and their journey. #tag outro. Phew. Okay, what a journey that was. We've really traveled from those broad strokes of just imagining your character all the way down into the nitty-gritty, the intricate dance of ability scores, skills, proficiency, and the satisfying click-clack of that D20. Hmm. We've seen how every single choice you make, right, from your character's race and class through their background, maybe even picking specific feats, how it all feeds into those core 6 abilities, and how those abilities then drive almost every single action you take in the game.
Yeah, it all connects.
It really makes your character's strengths, their weaknesses, even parts of their personality feel quantified, you know, and deeply personal with every success and every failure rolled on those dice.
And this raises, I think, an important question for you, the player, to really ponder as you're building your next character, or maybe even thinking about your current one.
Yeah.
The player's handbook, as we've seen, provides a really solid framework. It often suggests ideal ability scores for certain classes and races to optimize their performance, right? Mm. To create the most mechanically effective character.
Yeah, the best build thinking.
Exactly. But what if you want to create a character that maybe goes against that grain? What if you envision a wizard, but with low intelligence and maybe surprisingly high charisma? Someone who relies on sheer innate magical talent and force of personality rather than dusty tomes and scholarly study.
Or that strong rogue we talked about.
Or the strong but maybe clumsy rogue. Someone who intimidates with brute force, making those strength intimidation checks, rather than relying on pure deftness and agility. How might a flaw, something like Brunor Battlehammer's forgetfulness stemming from his lower intelligence, actually enhance the gameplay experience?
Yeah.
Well, it could create unexpected, maybe funny moments. It could challenge you, the player, to think more creatively, to overcome obstacles that a standard character wouldn't face. Or it could lead to really memorable character interactions in development as they grapple with that flaw.
Interesting point.
So I guess the provocative thought is this. Consider the balance between mechanical optimization making the best character strictly according to the numbers and narrative richness. That comes from creating a character whose quirks, whose imperfections, whose maybe less than optimal choices actually lead to the most surprising, the most memorable, and ultimately the most engaging stories at the table. Sometimes that perfect stat block isn't the most interesting story to tell.
Right, because it's your story, isn't it? Your character to bring to life.
Exactly. And the dice, well, they're simply there to reflect its beautiful, unpredictable, sometimes messy unfolding.
So embrace that creative freedom. Don't be afraid to lean into a character concept that might challenge the recommended builds or the conventional wisdom, because that's often where the most compelling adventures truly begin. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the heart of D&D character creation. We hope you feel inspired, and we invite you to continue exploring the limitless possibilities of D&D and crafting the hero, or maybe the anti-hero, you've always imagined.